Trump came in with so much radicalism on these trade issues.
The United States and China try to redefine their trade relationship. It's Wednesday, July 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us online at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Mongolia has a new president. How the outside world seeps into North Korea. Hong Kong's tiny apartments. Diet to control dementia. Monitoring vegetation from space. We get started right now with VOA Asia. Following a lack of agreement at the U.S.-China Comprehensive Economic Dialogue in Washington last week, analysts say they expect the Trump administration to impose stiff penalties on Chinese steel and other imports. They are also predicting the United States might go a step further and start questioning some of the rules of the World Trade Organization, which it regards as being unduly favorable to Beijing. The dialogue mechanism was created last April after talks between Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping as a means to resolve old sticking points, including a huge trade imbalance of $347 billion that favors Beijing. But the first meeting, which was co-chaired by U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and Chinese Vice Premier Wang Yang, merely had to highlight the stiff differences between the two sides. And at the heart of the differences were Chinese steel exports and the massive trade deficit. The United States feels cheap steel exports are resulting in job losses, a view echoed regularly in Europe. Scott Kennedy, Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, says the Trump administration would impose controls on steel imports by using national security as the reason.
I do expect at some point in the near future for the Trump administration to impose penalties on steel imports from China and perhaps a few other countries, justifying those limits on national security grounds. I don't know if that will actually fix the problems that the U.S. faces in its relationship with China or globally, but it seems like the natural progression in the framework of how the administration is approaching trade.
He said the U.S. government may go further and start reviewing its commitment to some rules of the World Trade Organization.
I think over the last 5 years, China's economic policies, the level of intervention by the government in different industries, its promotion of high tech in a discriminatory way, has raised, widened the gap between Chinese practices and its commitments. And given China's size, that's had a big effect on the global economy, including on the U.S. and its high-tech industries. And I think that has generated anxieties and doubts in the United States about the WTO's rules and whether those rules are good enough to constrain Chinese trade practices.
After the talks, Chinese Vice Premier Wang Yang said the world's two biggest economies need to cooperate and warned that confrontation will immediately damage the interests of both. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin blamed the trade gap between the two countries on, quote, Chinese government intervention in its economy. China recently began importing U.S. beef and took other measures to placate Washington, but these items are not enough to placate the new administration. Several analysts like Swarbha Gupta, Institute for China-America Studies in Washington, says Trump's approach to trade has completely thrown China's long-term economic plans off the rails, and Beijing is not being helped with signs of rising protectionism in Europe.
The Chinese have basically wanted to bring Trump and his team back onto the mainstream in terms of U.S.-China bilateral dialogue on economic and trade cooperation, the way it used to be during the Obama years or even under Paulson when he was at Treasury in the Bush this thing. Trump came in with so much radicalism on these trade issues, so they just want to maintain this in a workable format which is productive and results-oriented.
Scott Kennedy adds increased pressure and challenges to China's trade practices will help open markets and strengthen resolve among global trade organizations.
I think that's what you're seeing in the United States and elsewhere. And so the question is, to how does one raise American confidence in the WTO and multilateral institutions. I think part of that is helping rein in Chinese economic practices. And that is going to take not only the WTO and multilateral actions, it's also going to take the United States and other individual countries stepping up to try and defend themselves so that this system serves everyone well.
Analysts said the ruling Communist Party is not likely to make too many concessions and appear weak in its negotiations with Washington ahead of the crucial Communist Party meeting later this year. Saibal Dasgupta files stories for VOA from Beijing, and our thanks to him for this one. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Myanmar moves to amend controversial online defamation law. China escalates efforts to shut down unauthorized VPNs. China blasts United States over surveillance flights after mid-air confrontation. Australia disputes UN on deal over asylum seekers. Militant violence kills 10 Afghan journalists in first half of 2017. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. On July 7th, Mongolia elected a new president. Khaltma Batulag of the Democratic Party has been in office for about 2 weeks after emerging the winner from the country's first ever need for second-round voting. He's known in Mongolia as a wrestler and a businessman and now president of the country. VOA Asia's Sana Ali spoke with Julian Dierkes, an associate professor at the Institute of Asian Research of the University of British Columbia in Canada, who has served as an international election monitor in Mongolia 5 times, including for this presidential election. His research includes looking into democratization and political developments in Mongolia. While there was much that he found surprising about President Batulag's election as the new president, his past career did not surprise Dr. Dierkes.
His personal trajectory is not unusual for politicians. There's been a number of successful wrestlers who have then run for political office. In the last presidential election 4 years ago, the Mongolian People's Party candidate was a former wrestling champion. And so that, you know, it's just sort of prominence, right, and celebrity status that they parlay into a political career. That part's not unusual. His background as a businessman is not unusual. Increasingly, business people have been active in Mongolian politics. But in the end, that he managed to win and somewhat decisively in the second round certainly was not what I was expecting, in part because, you know, the MPP had won a big election victory in the parliamentary election last year. So the fact that now the voters came out for the DP was a little bit surprising. The other piece was that in that same parliamentary election, Batulag had lost his parliamentary seat in his home province. And so in some ways that seemed to sort of disqualify him from, in my mind at least, from national office because he'd failed in an election. And so why would the party even want to nominate him? And why would they rally behind him? But I was certainly proven wrong on that. And in the end, he was elected.
What was different compared to the other candidates?
Well, so that's where, you know, it was sort of a negative victory in a way because there wasn't much that really set him apart in policy terms. I mean, the two big parties, the MPP, the Mongolian People's Party, and the Democratic Party, are not clearly distinguishable on ideology or on the policy platform. It's not really what he stood for that I think he managed to win with, but rather how he stood for it and that he represented the Democratic Party in providing some sort of balance to the Mongolian People's Party power in parliament.
What were the main campaign promises that he made, and how do you see those unfolding over his coming term?
Well, I mean, the promises were vague enough that I don't think anyone's really going to hold him to any of that. So I think that's a little less of that's a tough one because the president's role in Mongolia is not an executive one like a U.S. president, right? It's a semi-presidential system. And so there's actually very few areas of policymaking that the president has direct control over. And so that also means that policy really isn't going to change a whole lot. The area where he does have some impact is foreign policy. And the other areas that he has a direct impact on is the judiciary. But really what I think is going to happen for the remainder of the year and possibly into next year is that now that he's been elected, the Mongolian People's Party will try to use their majority in parliament to begin to change the constitution towards a more clearly defined parliamentary democracy. And so I suspect that this is really going to consume politics over the next good, you know, certainly over the fall into the winter. This battle between the president and parliament. We've already seen the first shots fired just today. The president dismissed two ambassadors for having played a role in the election, which they're not allowed to do because at that point when they're ambassadors, they're civil servants. And parliament sort of fired back saying, well, you can't just send these people home.
What did you, in your personal experience being there, observe? And you've been there previously. What was different this election as compared to previous years when you were there?
Well, I mean, yes, this was my fifth time as an election observer. And the first part that is really impressive and amazing every time is the care that people take to organize this election and the dedication it takes. In terms of what's changed from previous elections, there's an ongoing effort from election to add more layers of technologically enhanced, if you will, transparency. The other big change from last year from the parliamentary election was that last year, for the first time, domestic election observers were allowed, so civil society organizations could nominate members to be an election observer.
Julian Dierkes, Associate Professor at the Institute of Asian Research of the University of British Columbia in Canada, speaking with VOA Asia's Sana Ali. Happening now in Asia, Beijing's ambassador to Washington says the United States and China face a historic challenge in shaping their future relationship. He said Tuesday, since President Donald Trump took office this year, the leaders of the two countries have set a constructive tone for the relationship. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're spending part of your day with us on VOA Asia. Despite North Korea's increased efforts to prevent outside information from entering the country, international activists say technology and market forces will eventually overcome state censorship. North Korea is one of the most isolated nations in the world, where foreign media is prohibited and most people don't have access to the internet. The Transitional Justice Working Group that documents human rights abuses in North Korea says the repressive state has even executed citizens for distributing media from South Korea. Still, it is following a pattern similar to other authoritarian regimes that view knowledge as power and have tried to limit and control access to outside information. This is according to leaders from Cuban and Myanmar independent organizations working to evade authoritarian censorship and outside information restrictions in their own countries, who were recently in Seoul to share their experiences and strategies with Korean counterparts. In Cuba, as in North Korea, growing demand for foreign movies and television dramas, not political news, has made smuggling in outside information an increasingly profitable venture. Using a variety of USB drives, micro SD cards, and DVD discs, the independent news organization CubaNet distributes through the black market a weekly compilation of video content, audio podcasts, and even entire web pages for its growing list of customers in Cuba. Rafael Duval with CubaNet says Cuban authorities charged with preventing the influx of foreign media are eventually co-opted by being bought off and often becoming users themselves.
I believe that the increase of internet penetration is going to be inevitable. Eventually, the government will need this and needs this for its own development. Then they're going to realize the impossibility of a ban because of corruption.
Another Cuban project called Apretas targeted the country's elites and the estimated 25% of Cubans who have access to email. Apretas works as a proxy search engine in which volunteers in places like Florida email results of over 100,000 Cuban inquiries each month. Apretas founder Salvi Pascal.
So right now, we're giving to the people in Cuba something that they really need. We're giving them a window to see outside the island.
Prior to democratic reforms that began in Myanmar in 2011, the military government highly censored the internet. But the porous border with Thailand and the proliferation of satellite TV receivers in the country made it easier for exile opposition groups to penetrate the country's information blockade. The North Korean economy has been steadily growing in recent years, despite increased international sanctions imposed on Pyongyang for its continued nuclear and ballistic missile tests. An emerging private market that is tolerated but not sanctioned by the communist state is also driving economic growth. A survey by the Beyond Parallel Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington says most North Koreans now earn 75% of their household income from the black market. The number of households with TVs and DVD players in North Korea has grown to the point of being ubiquitous, says Nat Kretchen, deputy director of the Open Technology Fund. It's a group that promotes internet freedom and is funded by the U.S. government through the Voice of America's sister organization, Radio Free Asia. And the number of legal North Korean cell phone users has also been growing in recent years, but they increasingly contain inhibiting censorship and surveillance software.
It effectively blocked all unsanctioned files from being used on domestic phones.
However, for every measure taken by authoritarian governments to block outside information, activists are developing technological countermeasures. Our thanks to VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden for contributing this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. In spite of an earlier denial, the Chinese government has tightened its grip on the internet halfway through its 14-month-long crackdown nationwide. The anti-censorship group GreatFire.org tells VOA China has blocked at least 135 of the world's top 1,000 websites. Always available beyond the Great Firewall is VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. Micro-apartments are a new trend in design in Western cities where downsizing is becoming a status symbol. But in Asia, small flats are not a trend, they're a lifestyle. And as Faiza El-Masri has discovered in Hong Kong, the city that's often ranked as the world's costliest housing market, apartments are getting smaller and smaller, VOA's Faith Lapidus narrates.
This apartment building in the heart of Hong Kong would seem the perfect home for young professionals. But that's not how Donnie Chan feels, in part because his apartment is only about 18 square meters.
In the downside, I feel like, oh, come on, I'm back to this box once again. And I have to stay in this box for another, like, 10 or 11 hours, including sleeping time. So every time when I step back into this area, I do have this feeling. I kind of like a cat squeezed inside to a box, something like this.
The rent is $1,300 US a month, about a third of his monthly salary. In general, Hong Kong apartments are getting smaller and more expensive. But that can lead to creative solutions. When Andy Knight and his wife bought this one-bedroom, 28.7-square-meter apartment, they transformed it.
My favorite features in the apartment would be, for me, the home cinema system with the kind of on-demand surround sound and the two-tier seating. For my wife, it would probably be the kitchen and the fact that she can lie in the bath while watching her TV shows.
Architects Yanis Chan and Derek Lau designed the Pit Stop, a unit that incorporates furniture that can serve multiple purposes. Walls can hold a bookcase, but also swing out to create a communal space. The steps to a sleeping platform over the bathroom are storage cubicles. The desk or dining table folds up into the wall.
My favorite feature of this flat is the openable bookcase. Not just the bookcase is openable, but it actually functions as a
operable boundary.
Yeah, operable boundary.
This year, 30% of the more than 17,000 apartments set to be completed in Hong Kong will be smaller than 30 square feet. That number is expected to rise to 43% next year. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Developing at this hour in Asia, China is defending last weekend's encounter between two of its fighter jets and a U.S. military surveillance plane over the East China Sea. U.S. military officials say one of two Chinese J-10 fighters flew under and in front of a U.S. Navy EP-3 plane at a high rate of speed, forcing the crew to evade collision. VOA Asia Facebook has the story. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, scientists studying dementia are learning more about what the various forms of this cognitive decline does to our brains. But there are precious few treatments that cure, reverse, or delay this decline. However, a new study suggests a healthy diet can help. VOA's Kevin Enix takes a bite into the story.
The new research says the so-called mind diet can significantly lower the risk of cognitive damage in healthy older people.
It's a modification of the Mediterranean diet, and it takes on board the DASH diet as well, which is dietary approach to stopping hypertension or some such words. And so the features of both those diets were combined, along with other evidence for other foods that seem to be very specific to dementia.
Nutritionist Margaret Raymond has written a cookbook that lays out tasty ways to follow the mind diet. It is a colorful palette of strawberries, leafy greens. And the more colorful, the better.
It's largely composed of plant foods, and grains, etc. But it differs insofar as specifically, rather than just having fruit to eat, it specifically concentrates on eating berries, for instance, blueberries or strawberries. And it also specifically recommends not just all vegetables, but green leafy vegetables.
Researchers study places like the Greek island of Icaria, one of the world's so-called blue zones, where a large percentage of the population is 90 years or older. And they say people in blue zones are doing more than just eating healthy. They are just generally healthy. They do not smoke or drink too much. They exercise. They are social. They live well, and that translates to living longer.
You know, there's a whole list of them. Most of them actually relatively easy to do and cheap to do, by the way. You can actually manage as much as 33% of your risk that way. So it's a fun, you know, it's really better to think in terms of life course.
But Raymond admits living well is not easy. Our society is awash in cheap, bad food.
It's quite hard to resist, so it's tricky for us. We have so much choice. And we seem, you know, food has got cheaper over the years, relatively speaking. So I think there's too much temptation for us to do the wrong things.
But doing the right thing, laying off the burgers and pastries, may mean more meals to enjoy and remember. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Okay, so where can you spot all that good natural food, or at least a lot of vegetation? How about space? A new eye in the sky will soon help scientists monitor environmental changes with frequent high-resolution pictures of dozens of selected areas of the Earth, as VOA's Faith Lapidus takes a look.
Every 2 days, for 2.5 years, the Venus microsatellite will capture images of 110 plots of land in forests, fields, and nature reserves all around the world. The 265-kilo craft will provide the world's first regular, frequent, close monitoring of the growth and health of the world's vegetation.
The scientific mission is the observation of Earth, revisiting every 2 days, with a high-resolution and large spectral richness captor, which is unique today. The goal is to shape the influence of environmental factors, of human activities, and of global warming on continental surfaces.
VENUS, an acronym for Vegetation and Environment Monitoring, on a new microsatellite, could also help develop early warning systems for drought and threats to food production. The satellite, a joint project of France's National Center for Space Studies and the Israel Space Agency, will be launched August 1st from French Guiana. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Now that you've heard it, if you'd like to take a look at it, see that story at voanews.com. Some really great video with that and many of the other stories that we present each and every day. We also thank you for listening to us each and every day at VOA Asia. Don't forget to download our program if you can't hear us streaming. iTunes and SoundCloud are great places to get our program, as well as the voanews.com website. And of course, we're on every day at VOA Asia Facebook, a great place to visit. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Jim Harmon, managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Ali Ogden and David Berg. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day.